This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we take a look at the virtual war and cybersecurity. Defense One editor Patrick Tucker shares his insights into protecting our digital infrastructure. We'll discuss Israel's full-blown military attack on Gaza. Operation Cast Lead happened 10 years ago.
They were never called to account, particularly by the United States, who aided them in it. There was two more invasions in 2012 and 2014, and the general that headed up the last two invasions is now running for Prime Minister of Israel.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian. Russian hackers only need 19 minutes after breaking into a computer to wreak greater destruction and theft of data. That's according to a recent report by CrowdStrike, a computer security company. The Kremlin beat out North Korea and Chinese hacker groups who needed 2 and 4 hours respectively to go from breaching one computer to another. Cyber threats from Russia are sophisticated and aggressive, according to earlier findings and many experts. As a result, Russian saboteurs have moved beyond network intrusion into data manipulation and taking down power systems. Joining us to talk about the state of cybersecurity is Patrick Tucker, technology editor for Defense One. Patrick is also the author of the 2014 book, The Naked Future: What Happens in a World That Anticipates Your Every Move. Previously, Tucker was deputy editor for The Futurist. He's written widely about emerging technology for such publications as Slate, the MIT Technology Review, and BBC News Magazine. Patrick Tucker, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me.
The U.S. critical infrastructure is increasingly internet-connected, making it, of course, especially vulnerable to cyber attacks. What is the significance of the report that Russia's breakout time is only 19 minutes?
That report looks at what Russia can do in 19 minutes, looking at some of their past activity, most famously data exfiltration. So it's stealing very important and sensitive data. That's the kind of the easiest and the most basic operation that happens in cybercrime, the theft of data. It can be very useful for operators like the GRU or the FSB that want to carry out something like an influence operation or sort of embarrass a political candidate. For instance, when you get into something like infrastructure, then you're looking at something else, and that is command and control, which is a slightly different beast. Now, information that you steal on any particular command and control program or system, there's a wide variety of them. That is operational intelligence, but it's a little bit different to say that, like, when the Russians can get into your network, they can move around and they can obtain their objective in 19 minutes to achieve breakout. It's a little bit different from saying if you run a major power utility, the Russians will be able to seize command and control in 19 minutes. Those numbers are very different because there's this wide variety, of course, of different command and control modules for a whole bunch of different types of power systems. But the real threat there, in many ways, is that there are so many. As you point out, they are increasingly internet-connected. Remote access is a growing trend, certainly in utilities and power and water. And that creates complexity and not transparency. So you've got increasing number of interconnections, a decreasing number of people that understand all of the interconnections as they're relevant to any particular system or any particular area where a utility might be operating. And so that presents a very different sort of challenge than the kind that is sort of in conventional cybersecurity. You know, having said that, the Russians have demonstrated, in fact, it was the largest cyber to physical attack ever. They have demonstrated a willingness to affect and to knock out power and utilities, not in the United States, of course, but in Ukraine in the dead of winter. This was something that they've done historically on two different occasions to demonstrate their ability to do it. Of course, they've never openly acknowledge that they are responsible, but this is the realm in which they operate. They like to create the impression that they're capable of doing things without ever having it be confirmed in either, you know, international legal bodies or by international observers that it was truly them. So, you know, sort of similar to a kind of a mobster that wants the world to know that they're capable of great harm, but doesn't want legal accountability for what they do. So it is a real threat, but it just shows how different cyber attacks have different consequences and sort of different parameters.
I understand that many corporations are actually responsible for running some of our critical infrastructure, like the power grid or other utilities. And mm-hmm. I read that often the government assumes that those corporations really have in place good and effective cybersecurity measures. But in fact, that mm-hmm. may not be true. Do you think we need to be enforcing more rigorous protocols for the private sector to oversee some of those utilities or other industries that they're managing?
I think that sort of more rigorous enforcement of common sense cybersecurity standards and protocols is probably a great idea. When it gets to physical infrastructure, electricity, utilities, and things like that, DHS has a big role in coordinating among different utilities and seeing that it's a priority for them. And if you listen to DHS officials when they go and they give talks, they'll say that, you know, they work very hard at this coordination effort. And if you listen to Michael Rogers, the former head of Cyber Command of the NSA, in some of his testimony on Capitol Hill from just a couple of years ago, his predecessor has given sort of fewer talks on this, he'll say that the level of security is wanting in some ways, and he'll, of course, demur naming specifics because they don't want to embarrass, different institutions, and it's part of the problem. But the question then becomes, like, what would greater enforcement look like? And it might take the form of, you know, possible legal or financial exposure if you're cybersecurity standards aren't up to the highest that the government can come up with. And the government does do this very well. This is one of the things that government in this space really does very well. The National Institutes for Science and Technology has put together a list of cybersecurity standards and steps, and that's, you know, really very much best in class. And if you follow them, then there's a much higher chance that you're going to remain safe from any potential cyber attack. You certainly increase the costs on a nation state of performing something like that. And then there's a question of whether or not they should be mandatory, some of these standards. And that's a question that's been sort of kicking around for a long time, really since 2015. And there's a lot of folks that say the cybersecurity framework that NIST put into, proposed in 2015, that the White House at the time really championed, is a voluntary one. So on the one hand, it's a lot of different corporations say, yes, we're very happy to volunteer to be a part of this, but they've resisted, for the most part, any sort of like hard mandate in terms of being a part of that framework and paying attention to really living up to the highest possible standards. And there's a lot of folks saying, hey, maybe that's not necessarily the case, that shouldn't be the case. There should be penalties, there should be real consequences for not living up to that. At very least, I think you can say this, like if you're, because this gets into a broader discussion of what you think the government's role in this space should be, regulating private companies in terms of, you know, how they do their business, et cetera, even if it's a private company that is like a utility that touches the lives of millions of people. At very least, no matter where you fall on the line of, you know, government should be more involved in regulation here, government should be less involved, I think we can probably all agree that if you're a big utility or a major company and your standards in terms of your security aren't up to common NIST standards, and if you don't make that really apparent and available to investigators or different observers that want to, like, you know, check to make sure that that's the case, it seems like people shouldn't be buying stock in your company. It seems like, you know, if you If you look at like Experian and a lot of these different companies that have experienced these major breaches, I think that it's kind of also it falls to the media a little bit to point out like some of these breaches, some of these vulnerabilities that these major companies, when they fall victim to them, those vulnerabilities were listed on a government, you know, created vulnerabilities database. So these were known bugs that they could have fixed, that they could have patched, that they didn't, and that should be something that has, at very least, market consequences in a world where, you know, that's the most rational way to do things, and potentially legal and damage, like consequences in terms of damages, perhaps awarded by a jury.
Exactly. And this relates to something I wanted to touch on in terms of software that's released commercially that wasn't really thoroughly tested for vulnerabilities. Do you think that we should have higher standards for software manufacturers to test their products to avoid problems down the road and then be accountable to them, aside from the marketplace?
Yeah, I think there's a very strong argument that says that we probably should. But then the question is, how do you go about doing that, or how do you go about making sure that every new piece of software that's released is up to a particular standard? Obviously, you know, you would get a lot of pushback from a lot of folks saying, well, you know, part of the that's going to really slow the iterative cycle, and a lot of the software that's, you know, released now, it doesn't take the form of a new product. A lot of it is iterative software that actually is upgrades that have a security package that are installed in them, you know. So much of the software that we now release or that you now see released are really upgrades that are meant to address previous problems. So, and sometimes in doing so, it creates new problems. So while it's true that like the government really does a good job of finding vulnerabilities and publishing them, and that's information that different companies could use to really shore up what they're doing. Sometimes in the process of doing that and releasing new upgrades to software, they create new bugs that then have to go and people have to find and write about and talk about and then must then be fixed. So it's in many ways at this point a kind of a difficult self-perpetuating cycle of vulnerability patching and creating.
You wrote a piece, I believe, a couple of years ago on security analyst Dan Geer, who had spoken at the DEF CON convention, and said that we should treat abandoned software like any abandoned property. I love that, because he said if a company abandons a software code base, the same rules should apply that we use for discarded furniture. It becomes public and open source. If effectively, there would never be devices using software that was proprietary, but that wasn't properly supported.
Yeah, no, it's a fascinating idea. And I think that, you know, a lot of people heard that. Dan Geer's a really visionary guy, and what he does at InQtel or did at InQtel while he was there, really important work. But again, like the question is whether or not there's political will for some of those a solution like that, because that's going to be a potential loss leader for all the companies that make software, and they have lobbyists and they have a voice and they want to make sure that their political will is also known. So it becomes a question of how alert and aware the public is to some of these solutions that are potentially out there, and then whether or not we're willing as a public to have a conversation about which one of those makes sense. That there was, this is the difficult thing about covering this space in many ways, is that there's a ton of enthusiasm for new software and products. There's, you know, in terms of managers and executives, there's always a lot of support for innovation and innovating new things and creating new products. When problems happen, that's something that we, as sort of like a society, we then focus a lot on attribution, figuring out who did it, then seeing if we can affect that behavior with a penalty. And sometimes that sort of works, or sometimes it doesn't. And, you know, penalties primarily in the case of sanctions for nation-state operators and very recently Justice Department indictments. But, you know, there's a lot of reason to think that that's not the best strategy for this. And that's the most robust that we've really come up with. It's actually sort of a recent one, all of these Justice Department indictments against people that in other other countries working for nation-state actors that have perpetrated basically cyber crimes. So there's, you know, a real question of whether or not we have the political will to have a serious discussion about who's at fault when there's bugs in software that should be fixed, when there's unsupported software that's just out there sitting on people's phones and computers and home routers and increasingly just Internet of Things connected devices. Whose responsibility is it to fix that? And until you find a candidate who really wants to make that a part of a national conversation, because they're getting support for people that want that to be part of a national conversation, I don't see it really going anywhere, and that's sort of unfortunate.
Well, on that note, Patrick, in 2018, The New Yorker ran an article on hacking back or striking back. So let's talk a little bit about do-it-yourself responses. What is hacking back, and what are your thoughts about it in the context of overall cybersecurity?
It's getting a lot more attention now, and it can take, of course, a lot of different forms. So that's basically where, by some method, the perpetrator that's trying to get into your network to steal your data, you take the information that they have basically given you, whether it's sort of like a forensic trail saying how they got in or et cetera, but you attempt to do sort of the same thing to them, either to let them know that you've broached their network, potentially to steal information from them, or potentially to actually damage data. It's in a kind of a strange legal space. So that's going to give, I think, a lot of companies perhaps some reluctance to engage in it. It is something, interestingly, that the Defense Department under Cyber Command has been talking about a lot more. For instance, we know now that there were some attempts in 2018 to send by the GRU, by the same Russian cyber actors that penetrated the DNC in 2016. There were some attempts by that group to attack specific campaigns and specific candidates in terms of their email and their networks. And we know, because Cyber Command has said so, what the command's response was to go back and find those individual operators in Russia and give them a direct message saying, we know what you're doing, and you have to stop. So that's sort of a fascinating example of where things are going. There's a lot of support for that, and I think it's indicative of kind of a trend in the future. But the U.S. government and Cyber Command and the NSA, specifically Cyber Command, because that's going to be the outfit that's charged with actual offensive cyber operations and the hacking back. The NSA is an intelligence collection agency, and so even though they're now under the same umbrella, it would be Cyber Command's responsibility to do that. But they have authority to do that sort of thing from the United States government. There's a big question of whether or not a corporation might be liable in an international legal body, in a domestic legal body, in a foreign legal body, if they were to attempt to hack back against an organization that they felt had breached them, and perhaps in doing so had damaged data or things. And also, it's really important to know that a lot of these attacks that happen, sometimes they don't, like figuring out exactly where they came from, how they worked, it's a really difficult process. There's a reason why attribution is something that is hard. And sometimes you see, attackers using computers that aren't theirs, right? I mean, if you can take over command control of a computer that someone isn't using at that moment and use that as a method to breach another computer, you basically cover your tracks. You create like a straw man. Which one of those two targets is the correct one to attempt to hack back? That's a really big question when that happens. If you attack the wrong party, can they sue you? These are the big questions that I think are going to keep big companies from engaging in that behavior too much. But there's certainly a level of frustration among them, and they'd like to understand what more they can do in situations like this. And so I think that while there's going to be reluctance from the private sector to engage in that, there is interest in from at very least Cyber Command in engaging in hacking back on a state level where when it's appropriate. And I think that that's going to be part of the conversation going forward. But I don't expect a massive trend in that from the private sector.
And if history is any indicator, it's taken our laws a long time to catch up with technology. And in fact, they really haven't. I wanted to ask you, in terms of offense versus defense, how does weaponizing software vulnerabilities make us less safe? If you could comment on the U.S. government's practice of doing that and what it might do better to avoid having hackers steal NSA cyber weapons, for example.
Right. So if you listen to NSA officials, particularly Rob Joyce, who was the head of tailored access operations for the NSA before joining the White House as their cybersecurity czar, and now he's back at the NSA basically doing the same thing. In many ways, he's kind of the world's, like the United States' most important offensive hacker. What he'll say is that when the NSA or when the U.S. government discovers a vulnerability, there's a 90% chance they're going to put it in that vulnerabilities database and make it known. The 10% that remain, they go through a process. It's called an equities process, where they determine whether or not it, you know, should go into the vulnerabilities database, and they decide not to because it's something that's going to have like significant national security value to them. But most importantly, they don't anticipate that it will get out. So that's for them. If you listen to the way they discuss these things, Rob Joyce in particular, and I actually do think that he's someone with a lot of credibility on this, although, you know, there's no way independently to verify their numbers. That's an important point, too. I think that it probably does make sense, as they've described it, that when the NSA or when Cyber Command or when some other government entity discovers a vulnerability, they have an internal conversation about whether or not it's actually gotten out into the wild, whether or not it's potentially being used by bad cyber actors, and if it hasn't, how likely that is to happen. And if it's unlikely, then that's a vulnerability that they kind of keep in their little tool chest of secret tricks and et cetera until it gets out, and then it's immediately, or they experience it in the wild. They experience or discover someone using that vulnerability, and then they put it in the database. So in terms of how that process could be improved, like I said, I think it would be great to have some sort of independent entity that actually checks on whether or not it's true that NSA and Cyber Command are living up to what they say that they're doing and putting vulnerabilities in the database as soon as they get out into the wild or potentially beforehand. I think it's nice that, you know, Rob Joyce is very consistent on this number, and he's the one to really talk to about that these days. Before that, it was another fellow named Kurt Dirks who had a sort of similar figure. But these are just NSA representatives making an assertion and kind of hoping that the world accepts it at face value. If there were some sort of independent entity, like a privacy person, like a consumer or public advocate, whose job it was to really evaluate all of that, I think you could probably avoid a lot of problems. You know, the NSA in particular, they reacted to the Snowden disclosures very much as though what they had just suffered was a PR lapse, and it was bad for morale. And what they needed to do in the future was just communicate their message more effectively. There was never really a sense that, the tools that they had created that potentially violated law were things that they shouldn't have done. At the same time, obviously, we really are in a sort of technological competition with very large nation states that really do attack private citizens, private companies, and the U.S. government and our allies all around the world all the time. So I think that there has to be some way to have a better conversation about this stuff other than technological heads, you know, the head of the NSA or NSA operators or the head of Cyber Command going to the Senate and testifying on this stuff, because they're talking, frankly, to a non-expert body every time they do that. And if you watch the like quality of the conversation that happens between elected representatives and cyber operators on their craft, at least in terms of what's public, it always leaves me sort of scratching my head thinking, well, why is this the method for, you know, determining accountability here? So I think some sort of independent accountability entity that actually is expert class, that can respond to Congress people, that can be trusted with really confidential information, but still has an independent role as a public advocate, that would go a long way to stopping these any sorts of abuse problems in the future, and probably stopping at some point when it does happen, however much they wish that it wouldn't, the escape of vulnerabilities into the wild. But, you know, that's also something that some visionary policy person, some candidate or something, would have to champion as a cause, and it's not something I see right now.
We only have a couple of minutes left, Patrick. It's really fascinating to listen to you. I wanted to let listeners know that you and I actually met about 4 years ago to discuss your book, You and I actually met 4 years ago to discuss your book, The Naked Future, I think on a C-SPAN interview. And
yeah, I remember that.
Right.
Of course, yes.
I love the trajectory that you've made from that to your position at Defense One. And I wanted to ask you, what has been, just in a minute or two, your biggest takeaway in this position on cybersecurity that you maybe haven't covered? And one thing I wanted to ask you about is, how can ordinary computer users practice better cyber hygiene, and does that affect our whole ecosystem?
Yeah. Well, I think that my main takeaway since writing that book, looking at how the environment and the discussion around cybersecurity has evolved since 2014, I think that I was a little bit too optimistic about the potential of social media companies to do good with the vast data sets that they were acquiring. I still think that they do have a lot of potential to be good, to do good, and that we should have a very different discussion about privacy, one that's transactional. But I would have, I have a couple of points in the book that I would have really put more front and center. I go through them really quickly, but you know, they really needed to be much more an important part of the future discussion. And that is, you know, number one, individuals should claim the right to their own personal data. There should be laws, there should be regulations that prohibit companies from using large amounts of data that they capture on individuals in a way that would be deleterious to that individual's interests, that would be counter to that individual's interests. There should be laws governing that, and that will allow much more voluntary and happy and benign collection of data, as long as there's actual enforcement of that. That would be the first thing. The second thing I would say is that encryption, end-to-end encryption, needs to be a feature on every device, consumer device. The third thing is that all of the apps on your phone, you should have some method for understanding exactly what they're doing with your data, where it goes to third parties, to fourth parties, et cetera. It should be like a visualization feature as part of every app. There is a couple of phones that like have this, but they're not very popular because they're not made by Apple or Google or et cetera. So there has to be enforcement there because, you know, leaking data as part of a business plan for the technology industry, that's a big problem and it needs to change. So those would be like the main things that I would say that I learned from between 2014 and to now. I was right about all of those things, but I wasn't as concerned about their lack as I clearly should have been, because I, like so many others, have been so disappointed with the way technology companies, and particularly social media companies, have governed themselves and have taken their responsibility as data stewards for populations of billions of people somewhat for granted, and that's really unfortunate.
Patrick, how can our listeners read more of what you've written and find out about Defense One?
Oh, well, just defenseone.com is where we are at. We have two different newsletters, three actually, if you count the business brief. So you can subscribe to all of them. One comes in your mailbox every morning and lets you know all of the national security events all around the world. The other one is a list of all the articles that we've published that day. We have a weekly one that also looks at business trends from our business reporter, Micah Weisgerber. You can follow me on Twitter at DefTechPat, like Defense Technology Pat, just DefTechPat. And I'm on there a lot, and I'm fairly responsive. I'm probably on there too much. We care a lot about this stuff. We're very much focused on, you know, the effects of today's national security decisions on the future environment. You know, we really are setting the stage for, you know, how the world is going to govern itself in the future. And I, even though I'm, you know, cover a sort of dark, strange, Black Mirror-ish reality, I remain incredibly hopeful. just because of the amount of innovation that I see, the number of good people I see trying to make great things. That's what actually makes me excited, and I think there actually is a lot of reason to be optimistic about how technology is going to affect our lives in the next 10 years.
Well, Patrick Tucker, it's important to have your increasingly important voice on this matter and your positive attitude.
Sure.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Last month marked the 10th anniversary of Israel's illegal, massive, deadly attack on the Palestinian people living in the open-air prison of the Gaza Strip along the Mediterranean Sea in the south of Israel-Palestine. The attack was carried out with the political and military support of the George W. Bush regime during its final few days. Some 1,200 Palestinians were killed, including 500 children. This has been documented in the United Nations-sponsored Goldstone Report. Israel's continuing illegal settlement of Palestinian land and its dispossession of Palestinian people is made possible by American political, military, and economic support. But this support is coming under increasing challenge with Israel's violation of human rights and of international law being more and more widely exposed and discussed. Here to speak with us today from Washington, D.C. is Helena Coban. She is the president of the Washington, D.C.-based nonprofit Just World Educational. She's had a 45-year career of analyzing and writing about the Palestine question and other international issues. She has traveled to Gaza numerous times and has interviewed leaders and activists in all the major Palestinian resistance organizations for her own books and for other platforms. Helena Coban, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Good to be with you.
Since we'll be discussing today the events of Israel's full-blown military assault on the Gaza Strip back in 2008, and of course there have been two subsequent ones, one of them even more deadly, called Operation Cast Lead, can you outline where the Gaza Strip is located, what its population is, where they came from, and something about its economic circumstances and governance?
Well, good. Yep, sure. The Gaza Strip is located at the bottom right-hand corner of the Mediterranean, going up a little bit sort of into Israel. So its borders on the north and east side are controlled by Israel, and the short border on the south side is controlled by Egypt. The population of Gaza is currently about 2 million people. The vast majority of them are civilians, and more than 70% of them are registered Palestinian refugees from the war of 1948, when they were expelled and fled from areas that became Israel in that year and have been forbidden by Israel from returning to those homes for the subsequent 71 years. So these are 71-year-old Palestinian communities. Many of the, obviously, the original refugees have died, and all of them have had, well, nearly all of them have had children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and still their internationally recognized right to return to their homes and properties has been denied.
After the 1967 war, when Israel occupied Gaza, Israel built a number of Jewish agricultural settlements there, and then it subsequently dismantled them. Since that time, Israel has assaulted the Gaza Strip on three different occasions, each of which involved the loss of large numbers of Palestinian lives. One of those was the invasion by land and sea that lasted 3 weeks that Israel called Operation Cast Lead. And this, of course, is the 10th anniversary of that slaughter. Can you describe the Israeli reason for the invasion and the results?
Sure. Well, you know, the Israelis gave a public reason, which was to prevent the smuggling by the people in Gaza of things in and out of the Gaza Strip by tunnels. So you have to understand that when Israel pulled its settlers and soldiers out of the heart of Gaza in 2005, actually George W. Bush and Condoleezza Rice brokered an agreement that assured the free access and movement of Palestinians between Gaza and the West Bank, which is over on the other side of some Israeli-held territory, and other means of access and movement for them. But then in 2006, the Palestinians held a legislative election that was free and fair and deemed to be free and fair by the Carter Center and other experienced election monitors, and Hamas won that election. At that point, the Israelis just tore up the agreement on movement and access and started imposing a brutal siege around Gaza. So it's been besieged essentially since the middle of 2006, that is for the past almost 13 years. And so people in Gaza to get things in and out, and generally this is commodities, you know, diapers, cookies, cooking oil, whatever, have had, you know, an extensive system of tunnels along that short border with Egypt. There were also some arms that were smuggled in through the tunnels because, you know, the occupied Palestinians in Gaza, like people under military occupation anywhere in the world, have an internationally recognized right to resist their occupiers. And it's important to note that although the Israelis pulled their settlers and troops from the heart of Gaza in 2005, the fact that they continued very, very intensely to control the borders, airspace, sea access, all access to Gaza means that the international community, everybody in the international community, including our government, continues to consider that Gaza is occupied in a military way by Israel. So the Palestinians have the right to resist that occupation and to win their liberation, and they have on occasion used military means to do so, including sending rockets and mortars. They have very, very primitive, I call them bottle rockets. They're a little bit better than a bottle rocket, but not that much better, bigger, more powerful. But especially when the Israelis launch one of their, like, they've had many big incursions, as you noted, but they've also launched a lot of little attacks, constant little attacks, including the Israelis will shoot at any Gaza farmer who approaches closer than half a kilometer to that fence, that armistice line fence. So, and the Israelis, you know, send snatch squads in to snatch or kill people that they want to kill whenever they want to. So in the view of many in the international community, including my friend and colleague, Professor Richard Falk, Gaza is like an open-air prison. So that is what it's like to live there for these 2 million people, the vast majority of whom are civilians. That's the kind of the background to each of these three massive assaults, which you could describe more like being a riot by unbelievably well-armed corrections officers against the inmates than a regular war, because the people inside Gaza have almost no means of defense and certainly nothing capable of standing up to or countering the very high-tech, very destructive, and usually U.S.-supplied weapons that Israel has used to wage war against them. That's why you end up with these really tragic casualty figures in the Qassam-led assault back 10 years ago. 1,417 Palestinians were killed by the Israelis. The vast majority of them civilians, because it's a very heavily populated, densely populated place. And on the other side, on the Israeli side, 10 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians lost their lives. Well, 4 of the soldiers were killed by their own side. So the casualties inflicted by the Palestinians were 6 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians, which each of those losses is tragic, but each of the 1,417 Palestinian lives lost is also tragic. So, you know, there's this just gross asymmetry between the two groups.
What weapons did the Israelis use, and are any of these weapons banned by the laws of war?
Well, I think white phosphorus is the main one that was seen. White phosphorus is supposed to be used only for illumination because it, you know, it lights up an area, especially at nighttime or in bad lighting conditions. But it is extremely damaging when it falls on people or things. It sticks to them and burns very hot and very deep, and it's hard to get off. So there are definitely many documented instances of the Israelis dropping white phosphorus. They look, when you see those photos, they are strangely beautiful. But then you look at the photos of the kids and people in the streets on whom it fell, and it's just a disaster. So that's the main weapon system. And actually, after Carstled, they didn't use it in two subsequent ones because the international outcry was so huge. But beyond the weapon systems as such, you have to look at the tactics and means of fighting. So international law is very clear on how weapons should be used in war. And the two of the key principles here are that you have to, a fighting force should be at great pains to discriminate between legitimate military targets and illegitimate, largely civilian targets. And that clearly did not happen, because if you look at the casualty toll, including on that first day in Carstled, they targeted a civilian police academy, which is not a legitimate target. There are many other instances of illegitimate targets that they targeted. And, of course, they did not discriminate enough between legitimate and illegitimate targets. The other key principle is proportionality. And that's a fuzzier concept in international law, but you have to keep your response proportional to the threat that you face. And the Israelis had, you know, a few civilian wounded people, three civilian deaths, and a very little bit of physical damage from the Hamas rockets. So their response was in no way proportional. If you look at the devastation of Gaza, I actually went to Gaza shortly thereafter, and it was worse than Dresden or Coventry or any of these sites that were massively bombed during World War II. An additional thing in Gaza is that Israel is considered to be the occupying power, and an occupying power has a specific additional responsibility for the well-being, I would say even the flourishing, of the lives of the people in territory occupied. Now, of course, military occupation is only ever supposed to be a transitional thing, a transitional status en route to a final peace, something that the Palestinians have not been able to win since 1967. So they've been under military occupation for more than 50 years there in Gaza. And Israel absolutely has not paid any attention to its responsibility for the well-being of the 2 million people of Gaza.
During the invasion and its aftermath, there was a huge international outcry at the disproportionate loss of Palestinian life and the casualties that were caused by the Israelis, and the destruction of the Palestinian infrastructure, sewage treatment plants, water plants, schools, food processing. All these facilities were destroyed. Can you expand upon what the international outcry was?
Oh, yes. It started even on January 21st, 10 years ago in 2009, when the Undersecretary General of the United Nations for Humanitarian Affairs, John Holmes, was able to visit Gaza, and he was shocked. He said something like, you know, shocked to see the extent to which the civilian infrastructure and the industrial sector had been targeted and nearly completely destroyed. And I saw that when I went there, I would say in March of 2009, we drove up and down the eastern border of Gaza, and just mile upon mile of destroyed manufacturing facilities, food processing facilities, as you mentioned, water treatment. And you know, there were statements during the war in which Israeli military leaders, I think including the commander of the Southern Command, said, we want to send Gaza back decades. And of course, that's completely illegitimate under the international laws of war, because they were targeting civilian infrastructure, including industrial and vital utilities. So, yeah, there was an outcry, a huge outcry, by governments and by civil society around the world. So we saw, for example, the international solidarity movement sent people to visit Gaza. We saw the birth of the flotilla movement, where people were trying to break the siege of Gaza by sea. And a couple of those ships, the early ships, flotillas, got through, but I think after cast lead, none of them got through. This siege is really, really damaging. I can't express in words how damaging it is for the people of Gaza. It is like being in a prison when you can get there, and it's very hard for us as outsiders to get there. And, of course, when I saw that destruction, you know, Gaza used to be a very busy manufacturing place. It's got a highly educated population, many of them refugees, reliant on, you know, wage labor. And so there used to be a lot of furnishing facilities, you know, places where they made furniture, places where they did food processing, all kinds of light industry. And nearly all that was bombed by the Israelis in 2008, 2009. It was terrible. It sent them ways back. And as a result, Gaza is now almost wholly reliant on international handouts.
Yeah, which are being cut back.
Yeah. and then of course, you know, Trump cuts back the funding. So that is terrible. But luckily there are other donors to the United Nations Relief and Work Agency in Gaza.
Well, the Israelis have proclaimed they're going to put the people in Gaza on a diet and try to control the amount of calories they consume. But I wanted to go to the Goldstone Report, Helena. The Goldstone Report was issued under the auspices of the United Nations, and it cataloged what happened to the people of Gaza and its violations of international law. And I wanted to ask you about it. Who was Goldstone? I know you've met him. What was the U.S. response to the Goldstone Report? What happened to the report? What happened to Goldstone?
So, yes, Judge Richard Goldstone had been a commercial judge in South Africa in the days of apartheid, and he played a minor role as the head of an investigation commission in those days, and then he thereby came to the attention of the international community, and he became the first chief prosecutor of the International Criminal Tribunal for former Yugoslavia, which was formed in the early 90s, and then also of Rwanda. I met and interviewed him a couple of times in the early aughts when he was still in The Hague. So he was, by that time, a sort of a distinguished international jurist, although his specialty had never traditionally been international law or international humanitarian law, the laws of war. So the UN voted in, you know, late January 2009, amidst this horror at what had happened in Gaza, to create a fact-finding commission, and it was headed by Goldstone. There were three other distinguished international jurists, all of whom did actually have a background in international humanitarian law and international law. Christine Chinkin, Hina Silani, somebody else. So it was a four-member commission, and they had to report back with recommendations to the Security Council in the form of a report, which they presented, I believe, in September of 2009. And it was called the Goldstone Report, and it accused both the Israel Defense Forces and Palestinian militants of war crimes and possible crimes against humanity. So it did so on the basis that in the case of the Palestinian militants, as I mentioned, they had only this very primitive weaponry, which does not have precision guidance capabilities. So if you look at the casualties on the Israeli side, the fact that the Palestinians killed 6 Israeli soldiers and 3 Israeli civilians indicates to me that there was no particular targeting of civilians, but rather a very close targeting of soldiers. And I think most of those soldiers died near the border, near the armistice line. So maybe there's a case to be made that they did not sufficiently, guide and target their rockets. In which case, obviously, give them precision-guided missile systems such as the U.S. and Israel and all, super modern militaries have. But on the Israeli side, as I think I outlined earlier, that they did not discriminate enough between legitimate military targets and non-combatant sites. So when the Goldstone Report was presented and found that both sides had probably committed war crimes and possible crimes against humanity, on the behalf of Israel and its supporters, there was an outcry. I mean, how could this judge possibly accuse Israel of having committed war crimes and possible crimes against humanity? So what the Security Council had actually said is that the Goldstone Commission will make its report, and the report recommended that both sides investigate their own military and bring to account anybody who had committed these violations, and that if that didn't happen, then the Security Council should refer the case to the International Criminal Court, which the Security Council can do. But it has to allow each side to make its own investigation first. Long story short, on the Israeli side, on neither side was there ever anything like a thorough investigation and holding to account of the military leaders. But specifically on the Israeli side, there were some very well-documented cases. There was the case of the Samouni family whose rights were violated in a terrible way. I think 21 of them were killed. There was the case of the Israeli military having dropped white phosphorus onto a UN school that was being used as a shelter for the displaced, and other attacks on clearly designated UN shelters. And none of this was ever investigated by the Israelis. In fact, just in December, very recently, December of 2018, an Israeli military court or Israeli court that had been investigating one of these more famous cases, the case of the 4 girls from Dr. Abu Aisha's family who were killed by an Israeli bomb, the judge in Israel found that there was no criminal responsibility by the pilot who had dropped the bomb. So that was the end. There has never been any accountability. And, of course, the Security Council has never been able to refer the case to the International Criminal Court because the U.S. nearly always, with very, very few exceptions, protects Israel at the Security Council. Judge Goldstone was unfortunately persuaded by people in his family and his synagogue to take his name off the report. And I should also note that in the lead-up to that, the Obama administration and his Undersecretary of State for Human Rights, Michael Posner, actually helped the Israelis to fight against the Goldstone report, which they had described as a poisonous report. So this issue of the United States shielding Israel is constant throughout Operation Cast Lead 10 years ago, throughout the Obama administration, and until today.
We're speaking with Helena Coban from Just World Educational. Please share with our listeners how they can contact your organization.
Well, thanks for asking, Michael. Yep, the our website is www.justworldeducational.org, and we have a pretty strong presence on Facebook and Twitter. We have just been wrapping up our project for the 10th anniversary of Operation Cast Lead, but we are coming up to another very important Gaza-related project that we're doing, because I hope your listeners are familiar with this movement, this amazing, nonviolent, creative movement in Gaza called the Great March of Return. And that movement was launched on March 30th of last year, so we'll be planning something big in the lead up to the first anniversary on March 30th of this year. We have a lot of other things that we do. We do a lot of anti-militarism work, but we certainly do a lot on the Palestinian rights issue.
In closing, Helena, I wanted to ask you about the candidacy of the former General Benny Gantz, who's running against Netanyahu in Israel. Gantz was the general who was in charge of two subsequent assaults on Gaza in 2012 and in 2014. The 2014 one claimed the lives of many, many people, including over 500 children. And Gantz is running, showing videos of the destruction of Gaza. I think if he gets elected, he'll be like the fourth Israeli terrorist to become prime minister. What are your closing thoughts on that election?
Well, it's a really sad thing about Israel that I have followed for many decades now. There used to be an amazing peace movement inside Israel, and that has kind of completely withered on the vine and gone away, and the Jewish Israeli public has moved very strongly to the right, and the militaristic tendencies that have always been there in the Zionist leadership are really rampant right now. And the idea that, you know, this party that Gantz is heading used to be the Labour Party, used to have, you know, quite a strong pro-peace wing in it, and now they are running on who is the bigger militarist, who is the most out-of-control corrections officer in, you know, punishing the people of Gaza again and again and again. But sadly, that is kind of what has happened to Jewish Israeli society.
Helena Coban from Just World Educational, thank you very much for being our guest on Law and Disorder, and keep up your good work. You take it easy.
Thanks so much, Michael. It's always good talking to you.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.